Good afternoon from the University of Southern California and welcome to Annenberg Radio News for April 2nd, 2015. I'm David Hidari. World powers reached an agreement today that President Obama said would prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Iranian students on USC's campus were surprised by the news.
I'm Arman Chafazian. Well, I was really happy about it because it's been, like 30, 40 years. And this was a pretty unprecedented event, and I don't think any negotiation at this scale has ever happened before.
Some of USC's Iranian students feel like the young Iranians have finally been heard.
My name is Puyan Behnamgader, Iranian youth. For a long time, we have been trying to make political, peaceful change in our country.
However, Israel and congressional Republicans are skeptical and say the deal doesn't go far enough to protect the US and its allies. California Senator Barbara Boxer said in a statement she'll work to support the negotiations. She warned her colleagues that disrupting the talks could jeopardize what she calls a historic opportunity to prevent Iran from acquiring warheads. The deadline for the final agreement is June 30th. Today, Californians are figuring out how to handle the new water restrictions from the state. Ronnie Reniftos has the story.
California, known for its endlessly sunny skies, has reached a near-crisis situation because of a four-year drought. Governor Jerry Brown, as a result, ordered a 25% reduction in California's primary water supplies agencies at a news conference yesterday.
The idea of your nice little green grass getting lots of water every day, that's going to be a thing of the past.
USC has already been trying to save water, says landscape worker Martin Ruiz.
We can no longer use water as freely as we did before. The university has been using plants that don't require as much water, and now we can only use water on plants that are clearly dry.
The student body, however, has varying opinions on whether USC's water usage has been efficient. The East Coast kids don't see a problem.
I'm from the East Coast, and like most of the colleges out there have way more like vegetation and grass and stuff, so I think it's better that we have less.
While the West Coast kids are frustrated.
So I feel that USC should take more on an initiative and become a more green campus.
Whether or not USC meets the new water standards is up to the state. The California Department of Water Resources says that there could be fines for those who don't comply with the new order. Rania Niftos, Annenberg Radio News.
This afternoon, California State Senator Robert Hertzberg called into the hot seat with Max Schwartz. Hertzberg sits on the Senate Committee on Natural Resources and Water.
Unbelievable opportunities to capture the rainfall that happens here, you know, the runoff off the hills, to capture the water that we clean and put in the ocean from Hyperion, and really dramatically reduce our reliance on imported water.
Hertzberg wants to work with the federal government to make sure we're able to use the little water that we are able to retain. At least 10,000 Los Angeles City workers are voting on whether or not to allow union leaders to call a strike. Logan Healy reports.
The vote comes after almost a year of contract talks between the union coalition and city officials. Coalition employees have been working without a contract since last summer. SEIU Local 721 spokesperson Coral Itzkali claims that close to 7,000 city services have been cut, with no plan to restore them. She says union workers believe L.A. is hurting and city officials aren't stepping up.
L.A. residents are seeing broken sidewalks, trash piling up on streets. We have dangerous school crossings without any crossing guards to keep our children safe, and it's really a shame.
Itzkali wouldn't say when the results of the vote will be announced. About 60% of sanitation workers did not go to work yesterday, causing delays in trash pickups. Union leaders are predicting serious disruptions of city services if workers vote to strike. Mayor Eric Garcetti criticized the workers' action yesterday, saying it would be better to resolve the contract issues through negotiation. Logan Healy, Annenberg Radio News.
McDonald's have announced a wage boost for thousands of workers, but what are the actual implications? Sarah Collins has the story.
McDonald's plans to raise wages by $1 an hour for employees of corporately held stores. The group affected accounts for just 12% of McDonald's employees, leaving nearly 660,000 workers out of the loop.
Well, I've known many workers who've had to move back in with parents. I've known some coworkers who just don't see them over a certain amount of time, and we don't know what happened to them.
That was Jameer Calhoun. He works at McDonald's on Washington and Hill, making $9.35 an hour. The store he works at is a franchise, so he won't see a change in wage.
People a $1 raise. And I don't want to take anything away from the people who get that raise, because I am happy for those people. I'm joyed to hear that somebody is getting a raise. But, you know, just a dollar raise and we're fighting for 15, I mean, that's one step.
Calhoun says he wants to see not only a $15 hourly wage for all McDonald's workers, but also a labor union to unite the United States' 750,000 employees. He remains optimistic that McDonald's will meet workers' demands.
Because it's obvious that they see the power that we have. They see the power of the people, of the numbers that we have with the workers.
But, Calhoun insists, achieving higher wages is about more than just McDonald's.
This is for everybody. This is for our community. This is for our city, our state, our country. So it's going to take everybody to be in.
For some, however, a Happy Meal is joyous whatever the McDonald's wage may be.
If a company can get by and get people, you know, quality people for $7 an hour, you know, I think that's fine, you know, but if they're going to have to pay $10 to get somebody to cook and work in McDonald's for $15, you know, that's what they should pay.
Calhoun urges everyone to continue pushing for change. Sarah Collins, Annenberg Radio News.
The man behind the Garden Grove's Crystal Cathedral has died. Sarah Tiana reports.
One-time superstar televangelist Robert H. Schuller passed away today after a two-year battle with esophageal cancer. He was 88 years old. Schuller started ministering his notably positive message from the roof of a drive-in theater in 1955. By the peak of his career, Schuller was preaching to more than 2 million from inside of his famed Crystal Cathedral, the world's largest glass building.
Dreams become conceivable. Then dreams become believable. Finally, they'll become achievable.
After hitting the peak of success, Schuller passed the torch to his son in 2006. Family feuding and bankruptcy tainted the transition, and Schuller eventually watched his empire crumble. The Crystal Cathedral was sold to the Catholic Church in 2011. Sarah Tiano, Annenberg Radio News.
USC's Keck School of Medicine has received a $10 million donation from the Stevenson family. The money will be used to create the Family Personalized Medicine Center. The gift will specifically help well-known cancer researcher Dr. David Agus with his work. Mary Alto, a patient advocate, was diagnosed with breast cancer at Keck.
I think that it's well-earned and it'll be put to really good use here.
The center also aims to create mathematical models which will hopefully reveal which treatments successfully fight cancer. And if you've ever wondered about the origins of curious words and phrases, here's Andy Vasoyan with today's Root Source.
The controversial new quarantine policy.
Quarantine stations in America.
21-day quarantine.
Quarantined.
If you have a communicable disease, congratulations! You could be part of everybody's favorite mandatory isolation period. Quarantine. Quarantines have been recently enforced in the Ebola outbreak, but to find out where the word came from, we have to go all the way back to Venice in the 14th century. Quarantine comes from the Italian word quaranta, which means 40. When ships were suspected of carrying the plague, the Venetians kept them isolated for quarantina, or 40 days, before they let them back into the harbor. Modern quarantines may not always last as long as a Venetian quarantina, but if you're stuck in one, you've probably got way bigger problems.
If you're trying to kill someone, then call up crime novelist Dr. Douglas Lyle. He'll not only tell you how to do it, but also how to do it in a very reasonable manner. Stephanie Case sat down with the murder mystery man to learn about his methodology.
Can you tell me about your consulting career? What exactly do you do?
Well, writers send me questions about their stories. They'll say, I have this person that's been shot and they're put into a basement and they're not found for 3 days. What's the body going to look like? And so I explained to them the science of gunshot wounds and poisons and what happens to bodies in basements after 3 days. I've answered over 6,000 questions.
That seems like the perfect marriage, because they've got the creativity and the story, and then you bring the facts and the science to the table.
That's what I do. And some of them, the ideas don't work because the science is wrong. And I just tell them that this won't work. But if you do this, just change this a little bit.
What's the wildest challenge you've ever got to make a story work?
One great one that Lee Goldberg, who wrote all the diagnosis murder books, he wanted the son to kill the father who was having a kidney transplant. And he wanted to figure out a way to put something into the solution after they took the kidney from the donor out. And then when they put it in the father, it was a poison that would kill him. And I said, well, that's a little difficult because people in the operating room notice stuff like that because there's a rhythm to it. I said, why not this? Have the son be the donor. You know, their family, the chance of a match is much higher. So the son matches, and it's his kidney that's going into the father. We'll have the father deathly allergic to penicillin, but the son not. And the night before, the son loads himself up with penicillin. Nothing looks different. Nothing smells different. Everything's the same. The surgeon doesn't know that the kidney's loaded with penicillin. Who would? And so he takes it out, puts it in the father, and bang, the father has an anaphylactic reaction and dies.
Wouldn't they figure that out, though?
It happens quickly and dramatically, and the blood pressure drops. In an operating room, when the blood pressure drops, there's two places you look first, bleeding and the anesthesiologist. And that takes a few minutes. What's going on? What, check this, check that. But meanwhile, the anaphylactic reaction is getting worse and the blood pressure's gone to zero. It could be found out. It could be completely overlooked.
What are some good mysteries or murders that have really creative science in there?
Dave Barry, he's a humorist, he's great. Well, he and Ridley Pearson, who writes thrillers, they were in Sun Valley once, and they were in a line at a coffee shop. And noticed one of the girls back there was grinding a bag of beans for one of the customers. So she put it in the grinder, a little bag out of there, and he noticed that Ridley was just watching it and watching what she was doing. And Dave said, okay, what is it? Because he knew he was plotting something. He said, well, do you realize that if you put a couple of drops of cyanide on those blades, the cyanide would be in the beans at the bottom of the bag. It might be weeks before they got there. That's how crime writers think. Okay? That's where stories come from. Now, think about the story you could build around that and how a detective would pull his hair out trying to figure out who poisoned this person and why.
That's amazing.
This is how crime writers think. You'd be sitting in a restaurant and see two people over there arguing. What are they arguing over? Money? The kids? Where to bury the body?
It's crazy that these are the things you think about on a daily basis.
Every writer does this. Every crime writer does this.
It's kind of a dark line of work when you think about it.
Yeah, in that sense it is. Crime fiction, you know, it's about crimes. And usually it's about murder. You know, nobody cares about embezzlement. You got to have a body somewhere. And your bad guy's got to be really bad. I mean, otherwise, how can your hero be really good?
Do you know a lot of people that, like you, start out in the medical field and then take that information and decide to turn it into stories?
Yeah, and it's a double-edged sword, and I had to fight through the same forest. Physicians and scientists of all types think linearly, fact-driven. Fiction's not that way. Fiction's messy. The story is not about the science. The science is merely the background. It's about the characters in trouble. And the science may be what put them in trouble. The science may be what gets them out of trouble. It may solve the crime. It may kill the beast. You know, it may save the world. But don't lose sight of the fact it's about this person.
So what do you want to do different with your books?
I want to write a good story. Isn't that what we all do? Storytelling is in our DNA. And that's the beauty of it.
That's it for today. We've had help today from Eliana Velasco, Emily Lee, Danya Sue, and Faith Miller. Our board operator is Derek Renfro. Rebecca Gibbion is the newscast producer, and the executive producers are Andy Vassoyan and Logan Healy. For all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm David Hadari.